David's not leading a small army here. He's got about 600 men and a lot of stuff to watch. Consequently, 600 bellies to feed. In Chicago these days, in Los Angeles, in New York, and I guess now Seattle and Portland, you might call this a youth gang or a street gang. I mean, they ask for something. If they don't get it, they offer to negotiate terms, but if they don't get it, they strap on their weapons and they go take it. And I'm not being too harsh on David here. At one point he says, I am a Hebrew, which we take to mean that he's Jewish and Israelite, but there's good evidence from the from Hebrew and Assyrian and other Akkadian texts that this word Hebrew comes from an Akkadian word, or is related to an Akkadian word, apiru. Which means brigand, someone who lives on the edge of the world, so to speak, and makes raids against what we would call civilized society. And so he's called himself that, and he is clearly an outlaw from the king. You know, whether or not we like the king, as the story has set it up, is irrelevant. Whether or not I liked Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter or Ron Reagan or George Bush or Bill Clinton doesn't matter. We still have laws to live by. And if I am being pursued by the government, I'm still an outlaw, whether or not you all know I'm the anointed of the Lord. This is the situation that David is in. And so let's go back to Ronald Reagan and say that Naval is living in Orange County somewhere. Someone comes out from Los Angeles and hides out there on the edge and says, oh, by the way, it's the sheep shearing festival time and I want to celebrate. I've got 600 men here with me. We've not troubled you before. How about giving us something so we can celebrate? And this is the response that he has. What he doesn't know is that this guy's about to be elected mayor of Los Angeles in the next election. You know, he can't know that. So he, like Saul, gets sort of a bad deal with the bad name and so on. Any response to that kind of an interpretation? These you guys just won't take the bait this morning. All right. So there is salvation here, though, at least a reprieve for Naval, and that is, as David's about to come up, if someone would pick up from 14 through 17, and we'll see what saves the day, the beginning of saving the day.
And one of the young men told Abigail, Naval was lying. David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and he shouted insults at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we never missed anything when we were in the fields as long as we were with them. They were a wall to us both night and day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know this, and consider what you should do, for evil has been decided against our master and against all his house. He is so ill-natured that no one can speak to him.
So everybody in the household knows who this guy is. He's irascible. And so they go to the one who's got some sense, tell her the story, and we'll see what she does next. If someone pick up 18 through 25.
Abigail lost no time. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, and 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, "Go on ahead, I'll follow you." But she did not tell her husband Naval. As she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her, and she met them. David had just said, It's been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the desert, so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him. When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "My lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my lord pay no attention to that wicked man, Baal. He is just like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent."
Thank you. Which translation are you reading?
This is the Student Bible.
You know, does it name the translation that it is?
New International Version.
Okay. Thanks. I just have to call him a wicked man?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I need to keep my ears attuned to those because the choice of words in the translation sends you off in one direction or another. This is, the Hebrew says a worthless, this worthless man. And it's an interesting slant on just how bad he is to call him wicked. So what do you think of Abigail?
She's no dummy, and she's not afraid of her husband. She just went ahead and took care of the problem without... She didn't tell him, but she also was concerned enough about herself and her household to take care of him.
Okay. So she understands the situation. As the text has told us, she's clever. And she takes initiative here. She runs right out to stop the situation if she can. How about her greeting of David? How does that strike you? How does she address him?
My lord.
David, when he sent in to make a request of Nabal, came with a polite warning and ended by calling himself your son, which is another way of saying your servant. She comes out and calls him my lord because she has a request to make, puts herself in the, actually gets down prostrate on the ground, bows to him, and puts herself in this subservient position because she has something to ask. Calls him lord, calls herself his servant, even though she's bringing him something. What she's asking for is the life of all the men in her husband's household, in her household. Basically, blows her husband off in this conversation. Don't take him seriously. He's an ill-natured fellow. He's a worthless fellow in the Hebrew. For as his name is, so is he, Nabal. So the pun is carried forward again. The pun also comes up in the two skins of wine. The word for wineskin here is nivle, which is from, if it's not from the same root, at least it sounds the same. So the author here, the one who put this down finally, is having fun with this this poor man who happened to be named Fool or Churl or Surly Guy, like a Saturday Night Live sketch of Crabby Man, Grumpy Man that Dana Carvey used to do. But I, your servant, did not see the young man. If I had seen these guys coming in, I would have done something different. So give us another chance here and we'll make things right.
But she said, put the guilt on me. Mm-hmm. Was that just her way of getting the men off the hook? And she probably felt that he wouldn't do anything to her?
I think she's got this figured out.
Yeah.
But it's it deflects everything. You know, here, what are you going to do? What can you do when someone comes to you and apologizes and they've got what you asked for and more right behind them, and they come to you and they fall on their face and say, "Oh, it was my fault." You've got what you want. What are you going to benefit by going in and taking revenge? She heard the proverb that a kind word turns away wrath.
And is the skin of wine fairly large? I get the picture of something small, but this is for 600 people or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's larger than we think of in the the modern that we see in Spain. It's probably a full small animal skin sewn up. But it's not enough for 600 men, and they're probably, I don't know how they would divide it. It doesn't sound like, what are the totals here? There's 200 cakes of figs. Except for the wine, it looks like they've got just about enough. Although five sheep is probably not gonna feed 600 men. So maybe they're gonna get some other stuff somewhere else. It could be that we only have one part of the story. David, there is a little problem here in the story in verse 22. God do so to David and more if by morning I have left alive one man in the household. David has taken an oath and put a curse upon himself if he doesn't wipe out these people. And that's a little problematic because the curse he puts upon himself just sort of evaporates. And I think that's interesting. There are several oaths in the Old Testament that didn't need to be made. This was one of them. There's not such an insult here that David is required to take blood vengeance on Nabal. And he made, I think, a foolish oath. And when he made this foolish oath, it seems that he had the sense to just let it slip away. There's an interesting story, a terrible story in Judges 13 about Jephthah, where he is in the heat of battle, promises to sacrifice the first thing that comes out of his house when he returns if he is given victory. And it turns out that the first thing that comes out of his house is his daughter. And he feels, for some reason, obligated to go ahead and fulfill that vow. I think this gives us an indication that there are other ways to go about this and that God may have a different idea of when it's necessary to make a vow and when it's necessary to fulfill a vow made foolishly in this piece. 21, okay, working backwards here, David had said, surely it was in vain that I protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, but he has returned me evil for good. What do you make of that? Okay, could be just justification. Any other possibilities come to mind? Let's remind ourselves of what the servant said when he went to Abigail. They were a wall to us both by day and by night, and while we were there, while we were with them keeping the sheep. Nothing did disappear. I mean, that part is true. And they were a wall. I don't want to press this analogy too hard because it will collapse. But when I think of some of the rowdies who hang out on street corners, keeping in some ways worse people away from certain neighborhoods, no one will cross a certain line, meaning that this shop owner is safe from other people who would come in and do him or her harm, because the people who would come in and do harm are frightened by the rowdies who hang around outside. And it seems that David's 600 troops performed that task at least temporarily. This is sort of like the Wild West, in the sense that there are always bands on the edge in the wilderness, just coming in and raiding, rustling cattle, stealing sheep. And David's men seem to be more disciplined. They're not doing that. David has actually protected them. David seems to think he has an implicit contract. I'll stay out here, and then when I make a request, of course you'll fulfill it. But he's never talked with this guy. Let's look at 26 to 31. What's going on here is the offering of the gift and the, again, pressing the case, just in case David hasn't quite made up his mind. She thanks him for not taking this blood vengeance, which is unwarranted and unneeded, and reminds him that this is almost a classical picture, classical in the sense of Greek tragedy, of when you come to the throne. See, everybody knows this, except for Nabal. When you come to the throne, we all know you're going to get there. You won't have this blood guilt hanging over you. And this is the kind of thing that pulls kings down in the classical scheme. Having killed someone in battle or by accident or in anger, not knowing that they, and never being cleansed properly from this idea of blood guilt. This won't be hanging over you. You really made a good choice here. Just in case David hasn't really made up his mind, she's going to press it one more time to make sure that he doesn't change his mind if he hasn't got it really set yet. May God bundle you with the living, and your enemies may he sling out like that of the hollow of a sling. Obviously a reference to the tradition that he was the one that had killed Goliath. Any other observations or questions about this piece? Also a reference here to the establishment of the Lord. The Lord establishing a house for David. It's a seems to be a reference to 2 Samuel 7, when the covenant is made, when Nathan announces the covenant that God makes with David. David wants to build a house for the Lord, wants to build a temple. And Nathan says, in true court prophet's fashion, oh yes, go ahead. And then that evening, Nathan has a dream, a vision, which says, no, I tell this to David. And then he runs in and says, oh, I made a mistake. God's going to build you a house, which means the line of David will forever sit on the throne. And David gets this perpetual covenant, this eternal job security for him and his family, which I think leads to the decline of David's line and his moral behavior. Although it hasn't been so moral so far, as we'll see shortly. Any comments or questions about this? If someone would read 32 through 35, and we'll see David's response.
And David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you? Unless you had made haste and come to meet me, truly by morning, there had not been left in Nabal so much as one nail. Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, go in peace to your house. See, I have hearkened to your voice, and I have granted your petition.
The power levels here are quite interesting. We start off the story hearing about this very wealthy man. Thousands of sheep, too much livestock. I wouldn't want a funeral back then in any way. And clearly set up as a wealthy owner of things. Picture of power. We have David on the outskirts of town of the civilization with another kind of power. 600 men at his disposal, and apparently more disciplined than most of these groups of brigands. And then we have Abigail with the power that she brings through wisdom and good sense. And then we have other levels of structural power. We've got servants, David sending servants to the rich guy. So David has power over these, his lieutenants, who go and make the request, and he presents himself as a suppliant. Then we see David's military power showing that he's not actually a suppliant. Then we have Abigail showing that, having servants come to report to her, showing that she is a woman of authority. And then we have her presenting herself to David as a suppliant. So the lines are all intermixed, and the power comes from various sources in this story, and is recognized at several different levels of the story, which I find sometimes confusing, but always fascinating as to who really has authority and power, and some of it is based on who's willing to pick it up and take it and use it. Remember, Abigail, as we noted, didn't consult with her husband in true Israelite fashion. A woman in this society didn't have power to make contracts at this point, we don't believe it. Although we know that women did make contracts. Just a few centuries later, we have some of them written down. But at this point, if a woman made a contract, the husband could abrogate it within, I think it's within 24 hours, maybe within a week, just by saying so. No, she doesn't. She can't make a contract. It's my stuff, and I'm not obliged. After she's cooled things down, then she talks to her husband. And if someone would read 36 to 38, we'll see what happens.
Abigail came to Nabal, who was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him. He became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died.
Okay. So yet another level of authority here, an even higher authority, directly intervenes. But she comes back, she sees it, and I think the reason that we hear about this feast, this party, is to show that this was going to happen anyway. What's a half dozen more sheep or five more sheep going to be and a few more loaves of bread? You got all this preparation going on for this sheep shearing festival anyway. This is one of the big festivals of the year. What's the big deal? Nabal should have had the sense to be giving it away anyway, to protect himself. It's not going to hurt to spread around some good cheer, especially with someone like David, who everyone else knows is going to be king.
Could it be that it was also showing how foolish he was again, because here he was in this mortal danger of these people attacking him, and he was just off being drunk? And
exactly, yeah. The world is about to cave in on him in the form of David and his 400 soldiers.
He has no idea.
Yeah, and he's drunk. So drunk that she can't even talk to him when she comes back. Yeah, it could have been, if it hadn't been for her, it would have been a completely different story. It would have been another story like we have in the previous six chapters about David winning great battles. Anything else strike you or questions?
It's safe to assume that the Lord is supporting David in this kind of mercenary.
Did you happen to notice the title for tomorrow's study. It's David the mercenary. And I think from the story, it's clear that God is. Even at the point when David is fighting with the Philistines, the enemies of Israel, God is with him. And then when push really comes to shove, it's the Philistines who will say to David, "You can't really participate in this war." Much like today, with the Israelis and the Arab Israelis, you know, there's a class of people in Israel who are Arabs and Israeli citizens, and they don't serve in the military in the same way that Jewish Israelis do, because the Israelis will not put them in that horrible position of having to fight their literal cousins and brothers. Some of it, you know, it's, as in every case, it's mixed. Some of it is because of the true concern for these people, and some of it is because of the perceived security risk. You know, when it comes time to push the button, pull the trigger, would you rather shoot a Jew or a Muslim or an Arab? And no one knows what the answer will be until that moment comes. But David is released from his obligation to the Philistines at that point, when there's going to be a real serious battle with the Israelites. Throughout the story, we hear that God is with David. And the story is very clear. The tellers of the story are very clear that David is the anointed, Saul is dispossessed, and it's only a matter of time out on the wilderness as a mercenary, as a brigand in some cases, until God brings David into the actual throne. I think this kind of story is useful in helping us to realize that the government is not always in the right in the way it uses its force and its influence. I think it's also problematic because it brings up for us cases where we twist the world. We see a kind of right so clearly that all other moral imperatives sort of wash out the window. I read part of an interview with Ollie North, in which he, after he admitted that he had lied to Congress, said there are biblical precedents for lying. And he cited, especially in military situations, and he cited Judges 2. Anybody remember her name? Rahab, right? She lied to the Jericho military that came looking for the spies from Israel. Yeah. Military conflicts, you know, it's fine to lie. And I think Soldiers of Fortune have a good model in David. The problem is there's no way to convince them that they are not called by God to be on the edge of society in Idaho, Oregon, Southern Illinois, preparing for the end times. Yeah.
Would you speak in general about the concept of vengeance and of forgiveness?
One covenant partner to another, that it's not necessary to go and take the vengeance. The Psalms are quite clear, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. It's not the that's a Psalm, that's not the New Testament. It's not our responsibility to make things right that way. It was part of the culture though, and it's something that it took that wasn't always listened to, and it took many repetitions before it made it into the Israelite culture and religion. And remember, that the New Testament is in fact an extension of Israelite culture and religion. It has Greco-Roman influences, of course, but it is, you know, the first members of the church were Jews. Jesus was a Jew who read this book, understood this guy as the one who was forgiving and called us to be forgiven. So it's not that, still because of the way the Luther Small Catechism was written, there continues to be a misunderstanding of the book of the Old Testament as a book of law and judgment and vengeance, and the New Testament is one of forgiveness. But it's, you read these stories and there's just tons of forgiveness. Any other questions or comments? So we got as far as God has killed Nabal, right? Now what do you think David's going to do once he hears that Nabal is dead? One of David's character pieces, you know, character flaws if you want, shows up here. Janet, this story, by the way, is one of those, is a great example, especially when you read the next piece. David sort of takes this psalm into account. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. What Abigail says to him is that you can't do blood vengeance yourself. Someone has to do it on your behalf. And the person who should do it on your behalf is God. The one who should do it on your behalf is God. Sort of the what goes around comes around theology. God will bring it around. David's response here in 39 or 40 is evidence of that. If someone would read 39 through 42. Okay, I'll do it. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has judged in the case of Nabal's insult to me and has kept back his servant from evil. The Lord has returned the evil doing of Nabal upon his own head." Then David sent and wooed Abigail to make her his wife. When David's servants came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." She rose and bowed down with her face to the ground. This is to the messengers, right? They represent David as if his presence were right there. And responds, "Your servant is a slave to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. Just don't make them the way they used to." Thank God. Now, she says this, but then look what she does. Abigail got up hurriedly. You know, she kind of, maybe she knew this message was coming, and maybe it's some of that David static, that chemistry when they met out there. And she brought him the gift, and rode away on a donkey. Her five maids attended her. Well, shoot, if I had five maids to be a servant, I wouldn't mind it. Five servants to help me be a servant, I wouldn't mind it. She went after the messenger of David and became his wife. And then there's a tag at the bottom mentioning another one of his wives. David also married Ahinoam of Jezreel. Both of them became his wives. Saul had given his daughter Michal, whom David had married before, after David left the king's household, David's wife to Palti, son of Laish, who was from Galilee. So, you know, David had one wife. Now he's lost her when he flees from Saul, and now he's no longer the king's son-in-law, but he finds two wives while he's out in the wilderness. Both of whom will later bear him sons, who become part of the court intrigue in 2 Samuel as we try to figure out who's going to succeed David on the throne. After Saul's death, David spends 7 years as king in Hebron, of just the south, and when he decides to go to Jerusalem and unite the two kingdoms, And he makes a deal with Abner, Saul's general. Excuse me. One of the things he asks for in the negotiations is for Michal to come back into his household, because that's his legitimate, that marriage is his legitimate claim, is the contract that makes him legitimate heir to Saul as king of the northern tribes. So so he's got to get her back into his household. Hoping, I'm sure, too, that she will bear a son that will be will unite the two kingdoms. But that never happens because she curses him or chides him after he dances naked before the ark because he's so happy. And then we don't know why, but we hear that she never bore children. She's not barren, it doesn't say. It's not a word for barren, but she says she never bears children. So it seems that she's exiled to the west wing of the palace. way out somewhere where she never really sees the king, but is sort of house captive. Yes, Jim?
Peter, was there any limit on the number of wives they could take, and where do Muslims of today get their limit
from? I don't know. I've not read the Quran carefully enough to know where they get their limit from. This is already problematic, that David has two wives in the sense that Deuteronomy 17, I don't know if you were here when we read that last year, it seemed like a year ago, last week, Deuteronomy 17, 14 and through 20, I think, talks about when you get into this land which I'm giving you, and when you decide that you need a king, and when I give you a king whom you shall choose from among you, not a foreigner, but one of your brethren, he shall not collect many horses for himself. He shall not collect gold and silver for himself. He shall not take many wives for himself. So the king is not supposed to do this. And the ultimate piece of not listening to this is Solomon, who had 300 wives and 700 concubines. And the problem here is, aside from the personal problems for Solomon, of course, the problem there is that Solomon actually, when he builds the temple, then builds in many of these wives are from other countries, from Egypt, and through alliances. These are all political. Many of these are political deals, showing the kings to be equal, so they intermarry their families. Solomon actually builds niches into the temple, so that his wives will be able to worship in the temple, in the official temple. So we've got the little Egyptian niche, and probably the Tyrian niche, and the Sidonian niche, which means all these gods that we hear it condemned throughout the rest of the Deuteronomistic history, Solomon, the most successful king in terms of money flowing into the kingdom of Israel, the United Kingdom of Israel, all those other gods are worshipped in this temple by his wives. And that's the reason for the consistent it's not quite consistent. I just wrote an article about how it's not consistent. But in the late period, consistent argument against intermarriage has nothing to do, it has only to do with religion. How religion is going to be taught in an Israelite household. If you've got a woman from somewhere else, she's going to bring her own gods with her. And we see that in the text. And that Solomon is the chief example of how bad it gets. And probably the reason for the anti-monarchical strains. 1 Samuel 8 has a similar picture of what the king will do to you, which is take your daughters for perfumers and your sons to run before his chariots, many horses and so on. There is apparently no limit. I don't remember a limit in the Hebrew Bible. And I don't know where the Muslims get their limit from. I wonder if Ron Young knows the answer to that. I'm sure it's from the Quran, but I don't know which surah, either way. And it's a limit of four if you can afford four. You have to be able to afford. You can't take from one to give to one. But for the king, obviously with Solomon, they didn't have any sense of any limits. And David doesn't seem to either. Not all of these stories are instructional for internal faith. I think except I'll go back to this one thing: to remind ourselves that even the great heroes like David were flesh and blood, human beings like us. Their stories make them larger than life, more faithful than life. But to remind ourselves that there's no implicit sanction of what David was about to do, and that David got angry and was on many occasions about to do something foolish. Cooler heads prevailed. In this story, if we're going to hold up a hero, I think it should be Abigail. She's the one who comes out and says, just think about this for a minute. There's another way to deal with this. Don't go to your primary sense of strength and self here. This may not be the tool that you want to use to solve this problem. And it works out fine. It works out fine for David. It works out great for Abigail. She gets rid of the fool for a husband, and David's property has increased. His stature has increased in the Central Hill Country here, once again. The story flows along nicely. So think about how you handle anger, and if there's not another way to let God be the avenger rather than taking it out yourself. Tomorrow we'll talk about David as the mercenary. Just take a look at some of the stories where he's really out there as an opiru, as one who lives on the edge of society. Even though we know from the story that he is the anointed of God about to take over the whole nation, he's really out there in the Wild West, almost like a rustler, stealing sheep and hiding out and fighting for whoever will pay him.
The washing of the feet goes back to where?
It's
associated with Jesus, but it's like,
oh yeah,
the symbolism of it.
Yeah, it's typical hospitality to someone who's walked to your place, come into your home, soothe them, get the dust off them before they come in and receive your hospitality. I need to say one more thing about that. This is this story of in 25 with Nabal. This should have happened anywhere in the ancient world. Someone comes in, you wash their feet.
Well, is it using an earthly element to convey a heavenly gift, or would it be like a sacrament?
We've taken it that way. We've certainly made it that way. And even in some cases in the Greco-Roman world, it was perceived that way before it was picked up by the church, as is Monday, Thursday tradition, which the Pope continues today. Hospitality to the stranger and to the neighbor were mandatory. I mean, if you were not going to be a surly person, a fool, a churl, when someone came to your house, you would be hospitable. To deny someone at festival access to the feast. The Muslims still do this today. It is absolutely unconscionable for a Muslim to deny someone a drink of water. So when you walk down the streets in Cairo, and I imagine other cities and where they don't want to be bothered with people coming to them asking them for water, you'll see households where they've just got a big basin out front with a dipper so that anybody who's walking by and get a drink of water. You know, beastly hot, dusty city like Cairo. I would never drink from one of those things, but if I were thirsty enough, I might seek one out. If thirsty and poor enough, I might seek one out. That's a sense of that is to me a sense of the holy, mm-hmm. and sacramental. But it's again, these people did not separate sacramental, holy, from everyday. They were of one weave. Mm-hmm. They were the same thing. The stories, when you hear most people, most academics these days talk about Genesis 18 and Judges, I believe it's 18, and maybe 18 and 19, but the two stories, story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which for years was talked about as the story against homosexuality, and the story of the Levite's concubine, the matter of the fact that it was men asking for a man to come out so that they might know him, that is, have sexual relations with him, is no longer regarded by most people as the point of the story. As is with, and like this story, there's enough set up around the story to indicate that what we're talking about is the ability to show hospitality, to be within yourself, to take care of the guest, the stranger in your midst. Immediately before the Sodom and Gomorrah story, we have the Abraham story where he runs out when he sees these people, runs out from his shady place in the heat of the day, and basically drags them in and shows them hospitality. When they go to Sodom, they're, you know, they can't find a place to stay, and they're treated badly by the people who live there, and that seems to be the reason that the city is destroyed. That they don't know the basic Near Eastern rules of hospitality toward a stranger. Similarly, in Judges 18 and 19, when the Levite goes to retrieve his wife, his concubine, the father-in-law feeds him 3 or 4 days. He keeps this guy, showing him hospitality, and then he goes on his way back. He can't find a place to stay, and when he does, a stranger in the midst of this Benjaminite city gives him a place to stay, a sojourner, and then the people of the town come around and ask him to come out. And that clearly is the reason. The woman is almost, the fact that the woman is raped to death is almost incidental in the story. It's the fact that they won't show any hospitality. They don't know how to show hospitality. And that tribe is almost entirely wiped out because they don't know this basic law of when you have a guest, you protect them, you treat them as a gift from God. In the case of Genesis 18, they clearly are angels of God. And that's the way one must treat anyone who comes into his household from the outside. Jamie?
Peter, having lived in the Sahara, you can see how that's just a practical. I think in Libya it was codified into law that you had to get drink of water. But I think of some tangents of that as the Moors went into Spain, and they had the story of Sancho, what was the story? The man on the horse and the man who walked. And so even today in Spain, it's very important to have polished shoes, and even in Latin America, you have boot blacks in the airports where people don't wear leather shoes anymore because to have dust on your shoes was a sign that you were someone who had to walk rather than ride. And I still see a different kind of hospitality in people with Latin descent, hospitality that we in North America do not know. And I think it still comes from that Moorish influence of welcome the strange.
You do see it in Israel. There's a lot of Western influence in Israel and among the Israelis. But I think the people who personify this kind of hospitality best are the Muslims still today. When I came back from Germany, which is from Berlin, which is the second largest Turkish city in the world, and one of the reasons they're having so much trouble with this resurgence of racism. There are so many Turks who came as guest workers, as they call them. I joked with one of my seminary professors that the most Christian people that I met in Berlin, this wonderful Lutheran city, were Muslims. Because they said things like, we always cook too much, please come again. And they're just students in Berlin typically live in the Turkish section of town because it's cheaper. And that's why I met so many Turks. There's sort of a competition to be the servant in these hospitality situations, to bring a gift, to wash the feet, to help, and it almost is like a competition. Oh, thank you. No, thank you. No, thank you. No. And it goes back and forth until finally everybody figures out, okay, we've got to the right point, let's eat.